This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
What's up, guys? This is Henry with Bro History, and I would like to take care of some quick housekeeping things before we start the episode. First and foremost, want to apologize for the shaky schedule as of late. We've been both traveling, Danny and I, and we've been trying to get something out before Thanksgiving. So last night, we recorded this episode over Skype. I know some people complain about Skype audio. I just listened to it. I think it sounds completely fine. So just wanted to give you that fair warning. Second, really just wanted to wish you all a happy and wonderful Thanksgiving. Make sure that you spend time with family, eat food, have fun, don't worry about politics, and hey, maybe even bring up bro history. You're going to learn a lot of cool, interesting things about the origins of World War I on this episode. So it's a good chance to make your family think you're smart. But this is part three in our Origins of World War I series, or Causes of World War I series. So I hope you guys enjoy it. What's going on, everyone? Welcome to another episode of Bro History. It's Henry Zamota and Danny Abdeljabbar. What's up, Danny?
Chilling, man. As per usual. How about yourself?
I can't complain. How are you doing? I know you're traveling a lot right now.
Oh, man. I've been gone for the entire month of November, and I'll be back on Friday, but you know, it's now Tuesday, and I'm literally just counting down the days. I mean, it's just been a lot of stuff. A funeral, two weddings, fucking whole lot of traveling. And just haven't been in my regular place here. So if this sounds, I don't know, maybe less than ideal, I'll just apologize in advance.
Well, we'll forgive you. We'll forgive you. Well, I'm sorry about, you know, the funeral. Earlier this summer, I had really bad wedding fatigue. Because we're at the age, once you hit the age of 28, 29. I don't know. Maybe it's different for different parts of the country, but in the Northeast, once you hit 28, 29, that's when everyone you know starts getting married.
In our case, so it's over like mid-30s.
Yeah. Now it's the age keeps on being pushed back. So a lot of people I know had weddings and then they were pushed back during COVID. So all these weddings compounded into 1 year. We had 18 weddings in a year. It was quite annoying.
I didn't have quite as many. I had 10 this year, but keep in mind, I live in Puerto Rico now, so every wedding I go to is a destination wedding. Like, I can't just mop over in a car, you know?
All right. So let us talk about what we're talking about today. So over the past couple of weeks, we've been talking about the origins of World War I. And the reason why we're doing that is because most people just start the story with Archduke Ferdinand, with the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand and how basically the political line system imploded in Europe. And that's why there was a war that killed over 10 million people. But no one really concentrates on the events and the different things that actually lead up to that being such a catastrophic or such a powder keg. So this series, we've been trying to do that, and we've been trying to tackle it from different angles. So the past couple of episodes, we've been mainly focusing on the polarization of Europe. So the transformation of Europe from a unipolar system to a bipolar system, meaning Europe developed into two rival power blocks that were almost guaranteed to duke it out. And by 1914, Europe was pretty much divided into two camps, the Entente, consisting of Britain, France, and Russia, and then the Central Powers, which were predominantly Germany and the Austro-Hungarian Empire. I mean, Italy was also part of this as well, but they went neutral when the war started, and they, you know, eventually kind of backstabbed them and joined the Allies. But, you know, this division is caused by a lot of different things, you know, such as imperial rivalries in Africa and Asia, you know, a different, you know, arms races that are going on between the British and the Germans. But most of all, it's really just caused by the creation of the United German state itself, because it instantly becomes the largest industrial power in Europe, and it becomes a really big rival to pretty much all of its neighbors. And the major problem was, for Germany, was that they were geographically vulnerable. So it was sandwiched between a revanchist France on its western border and the Austria-Hungarian Empire and the Russian Empire on their eastern and southern border. So the number one policy goal for Germany, you know, Otto von Bismarck, who was running the foreign policy in Germany, was to prevent a hostile coalition from forming on its borders, aka they wanted to keep France, whose land they had annexed in the creation of their state, from becoming allies with Austria-Hungary or Russia. Therefore, the strategy was to keep Austria-Hungary and Russia on good terms, so neither one of them would feel the need to join an alliance with France. However, there was a big challenge to this. Russia and Austria-Hungary had conflicting interests, and they had these conflicting interests and probably the most politically unstable part of Europe, if not the world. You know, there's two hot spots going on right now in world politics. One of them is China, with the tensions between carving up different parts of the falling Qing Dynasty. The other one is in the Balkans, with the same thing, with different powers kind of fighting for influence with the fall of the Ottoman Empire. Russia was using Serbia as a launch pad to promote its pan-Slavic agenda in the Balkans. And essentially, they were fanning the flames of Serbian nationalism. Serbia in the early 20th century, it was a mega cauldron for hyper-nationalist. And these nationalists were pushing the idea of a greater Serbia, which was a pseudo-mystical, ultra-naturalist narrative based on the idea of restoring the old greater Serbia of the pre-Ottoman Empire. The Serbian Empire was this medieval state from the 14th century that was supposedly like a glorious chapter in the history of the Serbian race. And, you know, it ends with the defeat of Prince Lazar in the legendary battle of Kosovo by the Ottoman Empire. Basically, they all fight to the death. You know, almost every Serbian soldier and every single Ottoman soldier, they all die in this battle. And the only reason why the Ottomans are able to conquer Serbia after that is because there's no one left to fight. I've actually found this quote from this book that was written right after World War One. This is the first sentence of the book, and this is all I needed. I was like, okay, I'm just going to take this quote. That's all I read in this book. Now, I read a couple of random paragraphs, but I just had to get one of these quotes. I was looking for a quote like this, and it gave it to me instantly. Slavonic nationalities are the despair of the historian. Their story is complex beyond ordinary complexity and bloody beyond ordinary bloodiness. To write the history even of that part of the Slavonic race known as the Southern Slavs or Hugo Slavs is like threading a labyrinth.
Jesus. I mean, it's a good quote. It's totally true. This history is crazy as hell. I mean, we've attempted it at least once before, and it's never super clear.
It's that no matter what time frame that you tackle with Serbia and the Balkans, it's always just very confusing because there's so many different groups, there's so many different countries. I don't think if you gave a map of the Balkans to really anyone, I think maybe 0.0001% of of the human population would be able to identify every single country and put them in the right map. I mean, I've been reading a lot of books on Serbia and not just like old Serbia, but, you know, the Yugoslavia and the Balkans wars and Kosovo and Bosnia. And if you get me on a bad day, I couldn't do it. I'd be like, fuck,
right.
I forget.
Right. Yeah,
where was Macedonia again? Shit. Like it's
somewhere
it's
in the complicated southeast, history. I think.
God, where was Albania placed again? Fuck, God damn it. I know where Croatia is because it's by the beach. But it's complicated. It's a complicated history with a lot of war, with a lot of resentment, and a lot of shit that went on. It's a really fascinating history when you read it. Certainly. Especially, you know, the pre-World War I era, the World War II era, where, you know, you have probably the most successful resistance to the Nazis anywhere in the world, with the Serbian partisan armies. It's, you know, the construction of the Yugoslavia, the fall of Yugoslavia, the wars in Bosnia, the wars in Kosovo. It's just an extremely fascinating and rich history. On this episode, we're going to focus on some of the things that were going on in Serbia, which really led to, you know, Serbia being that giant hotspot in the world and being the powder keg that really started World War One. Basically, they, you know, Serbia was the Ukraine of that era.
Yeah.
It was the Ukraine of that era. There's similarities, not just in that it was a hotspot, but also with, like, you know, different ethnic groups and border disputes and strong nationalism, having resentment of former powers or powers that were previously dominant over you, geopolitical struggles against, you know, two greater powers being, you know, Russia's involved in this, but also Austria-Hungary and the Ottomans are all involved, kind of pulling at the strings of of Serbia. So there's a lot of similarities, and, you know, I would recommend studying this history if you want to get a more holistic view of what's going on in Ukraine. I think it would be helpful. But something that is at the core of Serbian nationalism in the 19th and 20th century was their historic struggle against the Muslim Turks. So in Serbian history, the Ottomans are these terrible tyrants. They tried to, you know, erase the Orthodox Church. They confiscated her Serbian homes. They had oppressive laws where, you know, for example, Serbs can only own mules, not horses or camels. You know, churches were pulled down and replaced with mosques. You know, they couldn't worship in public. They couldn't have funerals in daylight. You know, Turkish men were granted, first dibs on Serbian servant women on their wedding nights. You know, everybody knows about the Turkish Janissary armies, where, you know, you have kidnapped generations of children who are forced to fight as slaves. You know, there's stories about these slave soldiers being sexually abused by their commanders. This was the narrative. And I'm not really an expert to tell you how true this narrative is or how close it is to real history or not. But the point is that this was the narrative. This is the narrative. So that's what really matters, what the narrative is. And the Serbs were a humiliated race. And, you know, the 20th century was going to be their time to come back to be a great civilization again.
Make Serbia great again. Right.
Yeah. And you'll find some analogies to the even kind of modern day domestic politics as we go through the story. Now, the problem for the Serbian nationalist was this expansive concept of what Greater Serbia consisted of. Because to them, it was every spot on which a Serbian Orthodox church or monastery ever existed, which is basically everywhere in the Balkans.
Right. We've actually said this a few times on the show, and it comes up every now and again, but It's just the craziest idea that, okay, is there a Serbian there? Or is there a Serbian Orthodox church? Okay, cool, that's Serbia. Literally anywhere. You know, you'd be on the moon. If there's a Serbian Orthodox church, that's also Serbia.
Well, I mean, to them, it's just that, you know, the Serbs were the dominant group there. And, you know, everyone, Croats and stuff, they're just Serbs. Like, everyone is just a Serb here, maybe with a different dialect of Serbian that they mm-hmm. speak. But, you know, the point is that everyone over here, they're Serbs. They're descendants of us. We should all be a state. We should all be one group. And, you know, we're kind of like the core of that. Here is a quote from one of my favorite historians, Ralph Rako. The immediate origins of the 1914 war lie in the twisted politics of the Kingdom of Serbia. In June 1903, Serbian army officers murdered their king and queen in the palace and threw their bodies out a window, at the same time massacring various royal relations, cabinet ministers, and members of the palace guards. It was an act that horrified and disgusted many in the civilized world. The military clique replaced the pro-Austrian Obrenović dynasty with the anti-Austrian Karađorđeviks. The new government pursued a pro-Russian pan-Slavist policy and a network of secret societies sprang up closely linked to the government, whose goal was the liberation of the Serb subjects of Austria and Turkey and perhaps the other South Slavs as well.
So I actually can't wait to talk about that murder, but we'll get to that later. Why don't we start off with what led up to the murder, and just so we can get some context on this, because I don't think anyone knows who the hell these two families are. So maybe you can explain.
You shouldn't be expected to know who these two families are. It's a very esoteric topic. I mean, I'm still having a hard time pronouncing their names, even though I practiced over and over again to do it. But the Obrenović dynasty and then the Karađorđeviks, they're kind of remind me of the Montagues and the Capillaries. What the hell are
Capulets.
They in the Capulets and the Montagues?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That they have that dynamic, or what's that old, rednecks. Those rednecks who would like shoot each other and had a generation long rivalry.
The Beverly Hillbillies. I don't remember the names of the two families, but yeah, I know.
No, they weren't the Beverly Hillbillies. The Beverly Hillbillies was a TV show.
I know what you're talking about.
Beverly Hillbillies was a corny TV show made in the 70s. It had nothing to do with the two families All right, I digress. The point is that these families were rivals and they hated each other's guts.
Uh-huh.
So in the early 1800s, and this is where we're going to start this, there is a wave of Serbian insurgencies against the local Turkish janissaries. So this is, you know, 1800s. The Turks still have control of the Balkans. These insurgencies, what they really do is they really just mark the beginning of the end for the Ottoman Empire in Europe, at the very least, in the Balkans. And the most famous of these rebellion leaders was a man named George Petrovic. And his name was, he was called Karađorđe, or Black George was his nickname. And he seizes Belgrade in 1806. Belgrade is the capital of Serbia. And Serbia, under Karađorđe, is free from the Ottomans for about 7 years until they come back. And, you know, they reconquer the place. Karađorđe is sent to Austria in exile. And then 2 years later, there's another uprising. And this uprising is led by a man named Miloš Obrenović. The difference between this rebellion and the previous one is this time the Serbians make a deal with the Ottomans where they basically get a level of autonomy, but are still considered a principality of the Ottomans. So after that, you know, these Serbian exiles, they come home, and you know, at this point they're coming from Russia or modern day Moldova, to be more specific. The Austrians had sent their Serbian exiles to Russia because, frankly, they just didn't really want to deal with them, so they sent them over to Russia, who had, you know, kind of more linkage and more ties to them. But Karađorđe was, you know, he was eager to come back for obvious reasons, because you know, he can come back and there's a deal in place and, you know, he has some room to maybe start a more concrete independence movement. Well, guess what happens?
I don't know. He has him killed or some shit.
Yeah. So Kara George, he reaches out to his close family friend, his godfather. His godfather's name is Vule, to help smuggle him into the country. And, you know, Vule is like, yeah, of course, you're my godson. I'll give you safe harbor. I'll give you, you know, a place to stay. So Kara George meets up with them, and Vule goes, pew, pew, pew. And then Kara George goes, no, how could you? You're my godfather. Oh, I'm dead. it doesn't actually play out like that. But what is true is that Kara George is assassinated by someone hired by his godfather, Vule. And, you know, they cut his head off. They send it to the Ottomans, and then his head is put on display in Istanbul or wherever. I think it's Istanbul where his head is sent, you know, as a message. Kind of Ned Starkish, right? Very Game of Thrones, where they take the head and you know, have that as your warning for rebelling against the king. It turns out that Vule, his godfather, is now on the payroll of Milos Obrenović. And part of the deal with the Ottomans, because the Obrenović dynasty is the one that makes the deal with the Ottomans, was to set up their, you know, opposing rival family faction, the Kara George, the Kara Georgevics. So he had to go. Kara George, Black George, had to go. So Milos, he is then anointed the Prince of Serbia, which, you know, really kicks off this bitter family feud that lasts about 85 years. And between 1817 and 1878, so those are the years that Serbia is a principality of the Ottoman Empire. It is just a complete and utter shit show. And to make a long story short, because we could spend the entire podcast on this era, these families just consistently kill each other. And then they replace each other with their own head of state through, you know, some type of insurrection or conspiracy or murder or assassination. So very few of these leaders who are going back and forth, you know, they're going back and forth between Prince of Serbia, are actually dying of natural causes. So Serbia is extremely politically unstable, to the point where governments are just completely collapsing. And it was completely normal for a government to collapse within a couple of years. This sort of changes in the 1860s. They have a new prince. His name is Prince Milan. He is the grandnephew of the original prince, Prince Milos. He comes to power after his cousin Mihailo, who does not have a prince heir, is assassinated. And after 1882, he becomes the first king in modern Serbian history. So there are two stages to his rule. Well, there's three, but we'll get into that in a second. The first stage, he rules as a prince in the Ottoman vassal state. The second stage, he actually rules as a true monarch. But what's important to note is Serbia is pro-Russia during the period of them being an Ottoman vassal state. After they get their independence, they actually start to tilt towards the Austrians. And the reason why it's like this is because during the Serbian War of Independence, they pushed out the Ottomans with the direct backing of the Russians. However, Milan, the Milan government, the not Italy Milan, but the ruler of Serbia, he wasn't happy with the Treaty of San Stefano, which was the it was one of the agreements that allocates territories to the winning parties after the Serbian War for Independence against the Turks. The reason why he was unhappy is because the treaty created a large Bulgarian state, this autonomous state, and Bulgaria was another that was under Ottoman rule for about 500 years. Russia had actually wanted this greater Bulgaria to exist. Bulgaria was actually more important to the Russians and Serbia because it was going to serve as a launching pad for their main dream of occupying Constantinople. Constantinople was the center of the Eastern Roman Empire, the Eastern Orthodox Church. You know, they kind of believed that it was their right to rule that. So the problem with this greater Bulgarian state was that it was going to absorb cities that Serbia had won in their war with the Turks. So these borders are actually revised after the Treaty of Berlin. So there isn't a Bulgaria that's created at this time. But the Serbian government, this attempt to create this Bulgarian state actually puts them at odds against the Russians. So here is a quote from the Institute for Political Studies from Belgrade. The difficult situation for Serbia was nevertheless avoided with the help and support of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, but it came with a price. The price of the Austro-Hungarian aid at the Berlin Congress related to the admittance of Serbia to its economic and political sphere. Before the Congress of Berlin on July 8, 1878, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Serbia and Austro-Hungary signed an economic agreement that applied to three areas: construction of railways, trade agreements, and questions of Jurdap. Jurdap was a territorial dispute. Although the trade interest between the two sides should have been resolved in a later treaty, the basis for the formulation of such a contract was unfavorable to Serbia. The railway, which was supposed to be built in order to obtain connections with the Austrian railways and with promised help with the connection to the Bulgarian and Turkish railways, allowed the realization of Serbian trade, economic, and political interests as well. The purpose of this railway was to essentially connect Europe and the Middle East together. That was like kind of the reason why there was international backing for this railway, because it was just going to increase trade between both continents. The railway contract concluded in April 1880. However, Serbians were afraid that the great material resources necessary for the construction of railways would greatly aggravate the state of public finances, so they tried and they succeeded in negotiating with the Austro-Hungary to reduce Serbian obligations. While the construction of railway in Serbia was in complete harmony with the classic understanding of economic liberalism, radical opposition objected to it for financial reasons, as well as the inadequate conditions of construction and exploitation. Given the large loan for construction of railway, 37 MPs demanded elections for the Grand National Assembly, believing that only it can decide on such important issues. Speaking about the railway convention, Nikola Pašić, in the National Assembly, said, and Nikola Pašić is the opposition leader, he's the opposition leader who belongs to the Radical Party. So they're the main opposition force to the monarchy in Serbia at the time. So they're kind of like they represent the peasant class. Mm-hmm. They represent the basically kind of like the normal folk, which Serbia had a lot of because it was primarily, an agricultural country. So the government emphasized that the railway promotes trade. The radicals explained that it improves the world trade, but not trade in Serbia. For the government, the railway is a modern achievement that contributes to linking the old and newly liberated parts of Serbia, as well as the inclusion of the country in the world economy. While quite the opposite for the radicals, it represented a massive, economically inefficient cost, but also a threat to the independence of development, the independent development of a country.
I just want to get this straight, because the nationalists didn't want the railway because they felt like it would harm Serbia's independence. Like, I don't get it. You, generally speaking, like, increasing trade would be good for a country like that, wouldn't it?
In short, they weren't happy with the deals that they were getting from Austria-Hungary. They kind of thought they were just being used for the railroads, and they weren't getting like the economic benefit from it, and that the Austrians were kind of the ones who are taking the major profits, and it's they were kind of stuck with the bills. That was the problem. So they were like, we're paying for this with our labor and our budgets, and you know, you're the one who's making most of the profit.
So is it kind of like, to make a modern comparison, like how when China goes to these underdeveloped countries in places like Africa or South America and like builds them a port or like a train or road or some shit like that, and they basically loan them credit predatorily, and then they say, okay, cool, we're going to use this port and it's going to bring you so much trade, but actually they don't, and China ends up making all the money and they get the bill for it. Is that kind of like the same situation here?
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good comparison. Another way that you can look at it is that so there was a trade agreement signed between Austria, Hungary, and Serbia, and it's a typical trade agreement that you see between any developed and developing country or emerging country. Serbia was importing Austrian finished goods. Meanwhile, the only thing that they were exporting was livestock and agricultural products.
I see.
And usually when you have that kind of imbalanced trade relationship, almost always is actually the better way to say it. When you have an imbalanced trade relationship where all you do is just trade natural resources or agricultural goods or livestock, you're almost guaranteed to be a poor country.
Right.
You're almost guaranteed to have like a poor, a worse living standard. And that's just around the world. If you just sell natural resources and sell commodities and you don't make things that other countries buy, then you're always going to have that kind of trade imbalance. So that was just one of the frictions between Serbia and Austria that's created through these kind of unfavorable financial deals that Serbia, you know, was kind of forced to go into.
Right. And this is all set up by that guy Milan, right? Or at least his family.
So it's the Obrenovich dynasty, and again, the reason why they pursue policies because Russia was kind of their major power that they looked to. So they reversed course and went Austria-Hungary because they were upset with Russia for, kind of favoring this Bulgarian empire to the point where Milan, the Obrenovich dynasty, hated Russia. Like they hated Russia because of that. So they make this pivot where they get this real close relationship with the Austrians instead.
And then they get a raw deal economically.
In 1883, there's a Serbia's Radical Party takes over parliament with a wide majority. And the Radical Party is just the opposition party. That's what they're called. They are radical, but that's their name too. So in response to this radical takeover, Milan refuses to appoint a government from the Radical Party. So what he does instead is he just creates his own cabinet of bureaucrats, which in turn, you know, makes, you know, when you bring in your own guys and you're an absolute monarchy, what that kind of does, the negative part of it is that all the mistakes that you're going to make in the future, they're all on you. There's no one else to blame, which makes you a bigger target. So as a distraction to a lot of these domestic problems that are going on, because Serbia is very poor. At this time, they're extremely poor. They're among the poorest countries in Europe. Milan declares war on Bulgaria, and they go to war with Bulgaria over a border dispute, really. Bulgaria, you know, declares their independence, or they officially declare a unified Bulgaria. But Bulgaria at this time is still technically a province of the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire is, again, falling apart at this time. So they don't have that much pull in Europe anymore. But the expectation was that while Serbia is going to invade from the west, the Ottomans are going to invade Bulgaria from the south. Well, what happens is that Serbia invades and then the Ottomans don't. So Serbia invades, they go in alone into Bulgaria, and they get whacked. So they lose the war, and Bulgaria actually ends up invading Serbia, and it only stops when Austria-Hungary says they're going to intervene. But it's a humiliating blow for King Milan, and he is eventually forced to abdicate in 1889. The straw that actually breaks the camel's back is that he has an affair with a secretary.
Oh, and he leaves juicy. His wife,
and he leaves his wife hoping to pursue a marriage with her. And usually divorce in royal families is pretty taboo. So
right. I mean, the King of England had to change their religion to do it.
Yeah. So he abdicates, and the crown goes to his son Alexander, who is about 12 years old. When there's a minor who is put up as king, usually there's some type of regency that's put in his place,
right,
until the kid comes of age. Well, a couple of years later, so this regency is put in place, but a couple of years later, when he turns 16, Crown Prince Alexander, he's hosting a dinner party for his cabinet members. And during the toast, Crown Prince Alexander has his cabinet arrested.
Oh.
He has
Game of Thrones there.
Like, very Game of Thrones. He's like, toast, you're all under arrest. Except just not in English. So the reality was, he didn't think of this. It was his dad. So the ex-King Milan, he coordinated this coup. And basically, Milan appoints himself Hand of the King. Hand of the King is not the title of what he becomes, but
it's pretty, just easier pretty, to think of it that way. Game of Thrones.
Yes, but think of it like that. Hand of the King. He becomes a chief royal advisor. He takes the title of King Father Milan. And this is what I meant when I said three stages of Milan's rule. He rules, as the primary monarch, but just not with the title of king.
Mm-hmm.
The way that this all plays out, it just completely delegitimizes the Obrenović dynasty. To add to that, this was not a liberal monarchy. It closed down newspapers. It put political enemies in jail. It excluded the opposition party from politics. All that bad shit that we associate with authoritarian governments. Well, the breaking point comes when Alexander takes a very unpopular wife. Her name is Draga Masson. Draga, she's about 10 years older than him. And, you know, she's actually one of his mom's friends.
Ooh, juicy.
Weird. It's like, weird. It's like in Arrested Development with Lucille and Lucille.
Mm-hmm.
You watch that show? You watch Arrested Development?
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Buster dates his mom's friend Lucille, but his mom's name is Lucille. It's a funny part of the show.
Super awkward.
But it's just weird. Dating your mom's friend is strange.
And maybe she was hot. Who knows? Do you think Draga was hot?
Maybe. Well, she had the issue was more like even more so than her age is that she was alleged to have had numerous sexual affairs with people who were high up in the ministry. So I have a quote from Chris Clark's book Sleepwalkers where he writes about this. It's pretty funny. During a heated meeting of the Crown Council, when ministers attempted in vain to dissuade the king from marrying Masson, the interior minister, George Jenkick, came up with a powerful argument. Sire, you cannot marry her. She has been everyone's mistress, mine included. The minister's reward for his candor was a hard slap across the face.
Bro, he just said, hey, man, we're going to be Eskimo brothers. You shouldn't do this.
Yeah. It's like, hey, everyone banged your wife. You can't do this. It's going to look bad on you, and you're the king. We can't have that. I'm going to continue this, though.
How about there were I got one for you. Wasn't like Nancy Reagan known around like.
Don't disrespect Nancy Reagan, damn it. The president's wife, former president's wife.
Hey, man. I'm not disrespecting her. Power to her.
I'll continue with Chris Clark. There were similar encounters with other senior officials. At one rather overwrought cabinet meeting, the acting prime minister even proposed placing the king under palace arrest or having him bundled out of the country by force in order to prevent the union from being solemnized. So intense was the opposition to her among the political classes that the king found it impossible for a time to recruit suitable candidates into senior posts. The news of Alexander and Draga's engagement alone was enough to trigger the resignation of the entire cabinet, and the king was obliged to make do with an eclectic wedding cabinet of little-known figures. So this marriage also breaks down the relationship between Alexander and King Milan. Milan resigns of hand of king, and he writes a letter to his son on June 1900. He declared that Alexander was pushing Serbia into an abyss and closed with a forthright warning, I shall be the first to cheer the government which shall drive you from the country after such a folly on your part. So his dad, this unpopular marriage ruins the relationship between dad and son. And the actual ruler who's running things is, he's out of the picture now. He actually dies a couple of years later while he's in exile in Austria.
Okay, so this story is admittedly very crazy. I read some of the notes before we came on, but just like talking about it out loud makes me like have so many questions about this. So the one thing I want to make everyone keep in mind is like this kid's like 16 years old.
No, he's older now.
Oh, he's older.
He's in his early 20s.
Okay. Well,
he's in his early 20s.
He's a young dude, right? Admittedly, very young kid who's the king. And
she's only like 30. 30.
Right. Well, I mean,
she's like 35 or something.
She's like his senior, right? His mom's friend. And so, like, the first thing I think of is, like, are historians giving this girl a bad shake? And, like, maybe they were really in love and they're really like fucking around, and I don't know, who cares? I mean, I guess at this time people did care if women were sleeping around. It's not like 2020 or 2022 or whatever year we're in right now, so like that wasn't frowned upon. But like I wonder how much of this was like exaggeration, and they just didn't like the fact that she was older, or didn't like the fact that she was like not anyone special, right? She wasn't anyone that would have furthered or advanced the, you know, the Serbian crown in any way. So, you know, I just think about, like, today, like, people hating on Meghan Markle because she's, like, a commoner and, like, probably also a little bit of latent racism because she's, you know, brown-skinned.
I think it's more, I think it's less of a comparison with her. I think it's more of a comparison with King Edward and Wallace Simpson. You know, that type of thing. Because, I mean, he wasn't even, Harry wasn't, is not in line for being a king. You know, King Edward was going to be king, but he, there was such opposition for him marrying not a widower, but a divorcee. I think she was divorced twice. Wallace Simpson from Hollywood. It was kind of more like that dynamic. They probably, I don't know. I obviously have zero clue what their relationship was like. I'm just looking at the perception of what historians have wrote. And what historians have wrote is just that it was very unpopular because of those.
Sure.
Maybe they are completely superficial reasons, but regardless of them being superficial or not, that was just the perception among the political elite in Serbia when Alexander was marrying somebody. It was just the narrative.
So this dude, you know, he's Alexander, the young king, you know, at this point, he's probably very unpopular, right? So what do you do to get out of that, like, string of unpopularity, you know, get shit? Because he was, like, struggling, like you said, like you read the quote, struggling to have just people fill his cabinet, like senior members fill the cabinet, and literally everyone's quitting. It's like fucking Twitter, you know. What does he do?
Allegedly, this is what they do, is that they think of this scheme to announce a pregnancy. The problem was that she wasn't really pregnant. It was apparently a lie, and it was a lie to gain public sympathy. So what their goal was, or their plan was, to adopt a child in secrecy, make that child heir to the Serbian throne. But
it'd be just easier to actually have a kid.
I don't think she could have a kid. That was the issue. That was another issue.
Mm.
So she was having, I guess she was having fertility problems.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, it was like it was a scandal where they tried to, you know, obviously there's nothing wrong with adoption, but, you know, in this case, that, you know, them lying about it, it just became a political scandal. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to, you know, create any moral judgment on these characters. And again, just looking at,
just telling the story through the lens of the history.
Just telling the story through the lens of popular perception. You know, they also do some really strange PR campaigns where they start naming, like, libraries and administrative buildings after the queen. Then there becomes a rumor that they are going to anoint the queen's brother as the heir to the throne. They became an absolutely hated monarch. In addition to that, it was not only like the radical parties, but the banking and merchant class turned against them. Again, they felt that they were getting screwed by these economic deals with Austria-Hungary. But most importantly, the military starts to turn on the monarch.
That ain't good.
So during the summer of 1901, there's a military conspiracy that's crystallized around this young lieutenant of the Serbian army. He's known as Abyss. His real name is Dragutin Dimitrijevic. I'm having problems pronouncing his Serbian name, but I'm going to read from Clark. Abyss was made for the world a political conspiracy. Obsessively secretive, utterly dedicated to his military and political work, ruthless in his methods, and easily composed in moments of crisis, Abyss was not a man who could have held sway over a great popular movement. But he did possess in abundance the capacity within small groups and private circles to win and groom disciples, to confer a sense of importance upon his following, to silence doubt, and to motivate extreme action. One collaborator described him as a secret force at whose disposal I have to place myself, through my reason gives me no grounds for doing so. So this guy is like the lead conspirator in replacing this monarch. He's also the guy who eventually plans the killing of Archduke Ferdinand, not to spoil it. But this is where the origin of that story starts. So the origins of the Black Hand group, the Serbian national terrorist group that murders Archduke Ferdinand. This is that. This is where that original conspiracy starts. This is where that network is created. This network that goes on to do a lot more in the following, decade. So what they first try to do is they try to poison them. So the plan was Abyss. He had planned this to kill the royal couple at a ball in central Belgrade on September 11th, which was the queen's birthday. And the plan was that they were going to take out the power plant, and then they were going to attack the power plant, the plant that supplied electricity to Belgrade. And then when the lights went off, they were going to set fire to the venue. And while there was a panic, they were going to grab the queen and king, and then they were going to, take a cloth, cover their mouths with some poison to digest. So that was their go-to. In 1901, they tried doing that, but it ended up failing because the queen was too paranoid to leave the palace and attend the ball. At this time, so they're so unpopular that they're complete paranoid messes. A paranoid monarch who's in fear of being assassinated, they usually try to not leave their home. And if they do, it's going to be max security. So that whole thing doesn't work out. This conspiracy, though, doesn't give up because they actually sign a blood oath. So they have some weird, creepy ceremony where they make this blood oath that reads, anticipating certain collapses of the state and blaming for this primarily the king and his paramour, Drago Mason, we swear that we shall murder them and to that effect affix our signatures.
So that's weird.
Yeah. I mean, this is the level of unpopularity that there was. And then, this, what they end up doing to get them is that they are able to just recruit enough people where they can storm the building that is heavily guarded.
This story's fucking crazy, by the way. So I just had to do this part. June of 1903, 128 officers of the Serbian army pull up to the main entrance of that royal palace in Belgrade, and they just start shooting. There was a pretty short gunfight, and the guards of the palace get arrested and disarmed, and basically took the keys off of one of the captains in charge and just let themselves into the building. They, of course, make a beeline to that, royal bedchambers, and it was like blocked with some big ass heavy oak doors, and they decided to blow it open literally with dynamite. Fucking dynamite. The blast was apparently so strong it blew the doors off and killed like a royal adjutant that was standing behind it like immediately, which is crazy. Just like have that sight in your mind. Just blow up a door, giant door, and it kills the dude behind him. Crazy. Also, by exploding the door, they apparently killed the power in the building, probably tripped a breaker or some shit like that. So this whole time, after this, they're doing everything in the dark, but apparently they end up finding some candles and they just kept going. So they're walking around in the dark with some candles, and, they reach the bedroom where King Alexander and Queen Drago were supposed to be in, and they weren't there. But they saw that there was like a book on the bedside table that was like still open, and they went and touched the sheets and noticed that it was still warm. So, they knew that they were there and they couldn't have gotten far. So they start looking around the grounds by candlelight, no less. And they're just shooting at random places that look like good hiding spots. Think of like cabinets and sofas and fucking tapestries, like in case there was like a hidden room or something like that behind it. And the whole time, the king and the queen were hiding in this like tiny little annex that the maids would use to like iron their clothes and shit. They apparently took that opportunity, allegedly, to put some clothes on. Apparently, they weren't dressed. It was nighttime, I guess. Obviously, must have been terrifying for them. Anyway, so they're having some these army guys. They were having some trouble finding the king because they were doing a pretty good job at hide and seek. And they grabbed the king's first adjutant, real loyal guy to them. I think we talked about him already, Petrovich. And they disarmed him and seized him after the gunfight early on. And basically they led him around the castle, in the dark again. And, basically asked him to call out to the king to see if they can get him to come out. And they were moving around the grounds. And finally they come back to the royal chamber for like a second pass there. And one of the guys end up finding the door to that annex that they were hiding behind some drapery. It was locked, of course, but I mean, I suppose they could have broke out the dynamite, but I don't know. But one of the officers proposed to like cut the wall open with an axe, and Petrovich basically like he understood that the jig was up, and he agreed to ask the king to come out. And from behind that wooden paneling, the king, and he was like, "Hey, come out, king." And the king was asking like, "Who's that?" And Lazar was like, "Hey, it's me, your boy, Lazar. Open the door, you know?" And the king asked, and I'll quote this apparently, "Can I trust the oath of my officers?" relating to the dudes who shot up the entire place, which is kind of a silly question to ask. But he asked it, and apparently the officers said yes, and the king came out with his arm around the queen, and they shot him immediately at point-blank range. Apparently, Petrovich, this is allegedly, I'm not so sure if this is like historicized or whatever, but Petrovich pulled out a concealed handgun somehow to, like last ditch to protect his master, and he also got killed. Now, all these people are dead already, and you think that that's the end of it, but like their bloodlust was not satiated at this point. Their corpses were stabbed with swords. One was torn with a bayonet. They were partially disemboweled. They were hacked with an axe until they were like just mutilated beyond recognition, which is just crazy, right? This is like, I mean, they really fucking hated these people, to go through those lengths. They took the body of the queen and they pulled it up to the railing of the bedroom and tossed it out, and she was basically naked at this point, into the garden. And apparently, and I don't know if this is exactly true, but it's part of the story, so, I'll read it. Why not? It was reported that the assassins attempted to do the same thing, like toss the king over, but one of his hands evidently closed momentarily around the railing. So he was dead. It was probably, if this is true, it was probably like one of those involuntary muscle spasms, but it like locked onto to the railing, and one of the officers cut through the fist with a saber. And the way that he writes it is crazy. It's like a bunch of blood and like falling digits and shit like that fell into the garden. Very interesting read. Good find, Henry. Anyway,
yeah, and we're talking about Chris Clark and Sleepwalkers. Right. The opening chapter goes over this murder, but this is where the story is primarily coming from, the story about the murder. But keep right. on going.
Sure.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. To follow trends, track financial situations, follow gains and losses, check out the Yahoo Finance podcast. Every day, we'll give you a quick overview of the latest market and financial news that you need to know. You'll be able to hear about the biggest headlines in the business world in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. It's perfect to listen to while you make another cup of coffee or work out a new budget. Check it out now. Listen to Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
So that's what happened at the palace in Belgrade. But like a bunch of things were happening all over Belgrade, and where, you know, these folks had found additional victims, many of whom were killed. For example, the queen's two brothers, who were suspected of, like, you know, wanting to usurp the throne or at least come to the throne. One of them that they said that, you know, we had mentioned this before, that the queen was trying to make one of her brothers into the heir. Those guys were taken to a guardhouse close to the palace and they stabbed them. So those guys died. Assassins also broke into the apartments of the prime minister. Oh, Jesus, these names. Dmitrija Markovic and the minister of war, Milovan Pavlovic. They shot these dudes a lot. Pavlovich in particular got 25 rounds in his body. He ended up hiding in a wooden chest, so they just shot the shit out of the chest, and yeah, they killed him. The interior minister, Belimir Theodorovich, I think I did a good job with that one, he was shot, and they thought he was dead, but he actually later recovered from his wounds. And then all the other ministers that they found and arrested, they just placed under arrest. But basically, this was the end of the Obrenović dynasty that had ruled Serbia throughout most of the country's brief period as a modern independent state. You know, within just a couple hours, these guys basically announced that they ended the Obrenović line and the succession to the throne of Kara Djordjevic, you know, who was currently at the time living in Swiss exile. But yeah. That's the fucking story. And I think it's absolutely nuts.
Yeah, and that's how this family feud concludes, with one being erased. The new government is led by the Kara Djordjevic family. The new king doesn't actually lead them at all. He's just a figurehead. The statesman who's actually running this show is the leader of the radical party, so Nikola Pašić. And Pašić was deeply committed to the struggle for Serbian independence. So things like also like liberal constitutional ideas were brought into Serbia afterwards. So there was like more freedom of the press and all those, I guess, better things. But with that came the idea of Serbian expansion, which was the entire radical party believe, you know, was hooked on this, the idea of the greater Serbia and Serbia expansion. They were the party of peasants. And the best way to appeal, no disrespect, but the best way to appeal to the peasant class is through crude patriotism. But it was a popular idea. You know, it's a feel good idea. Like, we're the best. We're an exceptional people. It gives you purpose. I can see why, you know, people will. I mean, we're talking about dreary times. And if you're a peasant and you're kind of out of the picture, it's empowering. It's a powerful idea that you're this kind of exceptional race or this exceptional you have this kind of exceptional destiny. So Pašić, he had been in exile in Russia prior. And while he was in Russia, he became a major player in the Pan-Slavic movement. And that's where the Pan-Slavic movements, they originate from Russia. And they make their way into Serbia. The Serbs are South Slavs, while the Russians are the East Slavs, and then, you know, they look at the Poles and stuff as the West Slavs, but, you know, they had this camaraderie and shared religion with the South Slavs, unlike the, you know, the Western Slavs, who in many had converted to Catholicism. There was something called the draft plan, this old foreign policy paper that was written in 1844, and Clark says, it would be difficult to overstate the influence of this document on generations of Serb politicians and patriots. In time, it became the Magna Carta of Serb nationalism. And the first commandment of Serbian policy was the principle of national unity, meaning the unification of all Serbs within the boundaries of the Serbian state, where, to pull this back to the beginning of the show, where a Serb dwells, that is Serbia. And this template that's used to create this larger, you know, this greater Serbian state was the Serbian medieval empire, which covered the entirety of present day Albania, most of Macedonia, and then all of, all of central and northern Greece. They had argued that virtually all the inhabitants of these lands were essentially Serbs. So the new, and I guess maybe a modern day way that you can, a modern way comparison, if you want to look at Russia, you know, Russia will be like, hey, they're Russians. They just don't know they're Russians type of thing.
Right.
You know,
when referring to Ukrainians, that is.
Yeah. And Ukrainians do the same thing. Like, they're Ukrainians. They just don't know it.
Yeah.
You guys don't even know what you are. You're Ukrainians. You're Russians. It's a lot of it is pseudo. It's kind of pseudo history or, you know, pseudo science or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And all of it is complicated, period. I know we said this in the beginning. All of it is too complicated to really even boil down to one episode at all.
Yeah. And that's why we're breaking this World War One origins episode into a bunch of episodes. So we can kind of flesh out and we're not doing this part of the story enough justice because there's so many other things that we're skipping and not probably concentrating on as much, but we're doing our best to get the main points across and not do a 50-hour audiobook.
So also, these are the parts that we liked the most. So yeah.
This is important. This is probably the most important thing to take from this. And what I'm trying to kind of combine together is all these things that we spoke about in the beginning and all the things that we already know about Serbia and World War One. So first things first, there's hyper-nationalism going on in Serbia with this concept of greater Serbia. Now, the new government created these secret committees. And these secret committees, they were sponsoring Serbian guerrilla movements in different parts of the Balkans. So these secret committees were ran by the regicide network that killed King Alexander, where, you know, they're the ones who are actually on the ground fostering these movements. So guys like Abyss are the ones who are on the ground and like mentoring and training young Serbian guerrillas. But there was a layer of plausible deniability. It's kind of like when the CIA, sponsors like death squads in Nicaragua or sponsors like hardcore Muslim Brotherhood in Syria. There's a layer of plausible deniability with this because after the coup in 1903 was so gruesome in Serbia that the public facing part of the government kept their distance from the group that actually perpetrated the regicide. So they could say when people would bring it up, they'd be like, hey, what are you doing here? Like, are you training these Serbian nationals to overthrow their government? And they'd be like, no, we'd have nothing to do with them. Like, they're just Serbian nationals. We don't have any connection with them. So there'd always be this layer of deniability whenever that would happen. Now, this new sense of nationalism brought about a really big, you know, a lot of antagonism between Serbia and Austria-Hungary. Austria-Hungary, they did things like they sanctioned them. They did something called the Pig War, which was essentially that the Austrian-Hungarians they denied Serbian farmers access to their markets. However, shit really doesn't hit the fan until 1908. And in 1908, Austria-Hungary, they annexed Bosnia and Herzegovina. Prior to that, Serbian nationalists were mainly focused on their three-way struggle between the Serbs, Bulgarians, and Turks, and that was unfolding in Macedonia. That was kind of like their main theater that they were concentrating on. But in 1908, they really get hit with the fever. Their main focus becomes Bosnia. And here is a quote from the British minister of Belgrade. And this is after 1908, because Serbia was furious when Austria-Hungary annexed Bosnia. Every patriotic Serbian who takes any interest or active part in politics thinks of the Serbian nation not as merely including the subject of King Peter, but as consisting of all those who are akin to them in race and language. He looks forward consequently to the eventual creation of a greater Serbia, which shall bring into one fold all the different sections of the nation, at present divided under Austrian, Hungarian, and Turkish dominion. From his point of view, Bosnia is both geographically and ethnically the heart of Great Serbia.
Where is Russia in all this? Because we're talking a lot about the beef between the Serbians and the Austro-Hungarians for, you know, the reasons that we talked about. But earlier on, the Russians were kind of like quasi-involved in this story until the Serbians flipped their animosity switch towards the Austro-Hungarians. So, and in earlier episodes, we were talking about how there was a strange, like, balance of power between the three Eastern empires, the Germanic one, which isn't really a part of this story in particular, but also Austria-Hungary and Russia. So, like, what's Russia's play in all of this? Because I know they weren't just sitting around doing nothing.
So Russia's tacitly been supporting the Serbians. However, what actually kind of makes relations with Austria-Hungary and Russia and Germany very hostile is that they're still kind of cordial with each other. They're not at war yet. Russia actually gives Austria the green light to annex Bosnia. They asked them first. They said, you know, if you want to do it, do it. We're not going to do anything. And then that actually comes out in the public that the Russian government gave Austria-Hungary the green light. They did it because they had worked out a deal where Russia would get better access to Constantinople, and then the Russians would get, you know, better access through the Turkish Straits at times of peace and war. But when the deal came to light, the British actually got involved and they stepped in and they opposed that second part of the deal. So the Russians ended up getting nothing at all. And then when the Russians were thinking about opposing the annexation after the deal came through, the Germans stepped in and said that, hey, like, if you don't recognize the annexation of Bosnia, then we'll go to war with you. So Russia at this time had just lost the war to Japan, and they were in a weak spot. So they felt a lot of, and also Serbia was mad at them as well. So they were kind of getting it from all angles, and they kind of had to sit there and take it on the chin.
Mm-hmm.
So this caused the Russian public to be outraged at the Russian government, and Russian politics changed, foreign policy wise, where they had to pivot and they actually started supporting Serbia a lot more in terms of supporting, like, you know, the internal struggle. Because again, something that was going on was that the Serbians were pulling at the heartstrings of Russia. And then, you know, the Pan-Slavic movement was, you know, originated from them. So, you know, there'd be Serbian thinkers and nationalists who would be trained and taught and learn about all this stuff in Russia. So it was this collision happens that makes the relationship between all these countries just way worse due to the annexation of Bosnia. So that's kind of where they come in. But I think for the next episode that we talk about it, because We're over an hour and 20 minutes, and I want to do the actual lead up of the murder of Archduke Ferdinand and how that actually took place and what were the politics behind it, because we're at 19 right now, we're in the year 1908. There's still 7 more years before the war breaks out. So that will be the next episode where we get deeper into that and how this secret network forms. And then, you know, who was Archduke Ferdinand anyway? Like, why was he important? What was his actual policy towards the Serbs? So shall we wrap this one up?
Yep. Sounds like a good spot.
Okay. All right, guys. Thanks again for listening to another episode of Bro History. If you want to support the show, make sure that you rate and review the podcast. That is the number one way to support our show. Please rate and review the podcast, whether you are on Apple or whether you are on Spotify. Please rate and review. Another way you can support the show is that you join us on our Patreon site. So join us on Patreon, Bro History, or Patreon/Bro History. Danny, anything else to add?
No, man. That's all.
All right. Peace, guys.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.